In a world where one nation's sovereignty is under attack, where real danger lurks around every corner, a world where confrontation must be met with brute force, and the march of humanitarian aid must be stopped. In this world, one nation has managed to do exactly what it was trying to prevent. Operation Overreaction. Starring the Israeli Defense Forces, Free Gaza Flotilla, Benjamin Netanyahu, Hamas, and 1.5 million blockaded civilians. Also starring in the biggest supporting role ever, Cold Hard Cash. Operation Overreaction. Because sometimes you have to do exactly what you're trying not to do.
You are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org, Pop Defect Radio. And for the last 3 weeks, we've been covering the Gaza flotilla raid of the Israeli army on the ships. Covering it again, 3 weeks on, folks. And we got a brand new Al Jazeera documentary that was just released. I'm going to play for you in just a moment. You can find it on YouTube. It's called A Voyage of Life and Death. We're also going to be featuring news as well coming up about where that aid is right now that was shipped over in the Israeli ports right now, sitting there. We're going to hear a story about that. And also, Iran is now planning on sending aid ships to Gaza, which could heat things up real fast. So we're going to hear that in just a moment. We're also going to be hearing from artists that are boycotting Israel and not playing there, such as Elvis Costello, Gil Scott-Heron, the Pixies. So stay tuned for that coming up after this documentary. But first, the latest news coming out of the Gaza flotilla raid, 3 weeks on. Stay tuned. Free Radio, Pop Defect Radio, popdefectradio.blogspot.com.
An Iranian charity says it's sending two aid ships to Gaza in the coming week. It's a move that's likely to further heighten tensions in the region. Israel's navy presumes the ships will be controlled by those it calls hostile and is preparing to intercept. The Prime Minister's spokesman explains why.
The regime in Iran is the prime ally of Hamas in Gaza. And they have consistently tried to send to Gaza more deadly weapons, rockets and missiles that are shot at the people of Israel, at Israeli civilians. And of course, they have an interest in bolstering the Hamas government and in trying to undermine Israel's naval blockade. Obviously, we're trying to prevent them from sending weapons to Hamas.
Ayman Mohyuddin joins us now from Jerusalem. Ayman, this is an extremely touchy subject. What's the reaction there, and what do people think might happen?
Well, certainly if the Israeli public's attitude towards the Mavi Marmara, as well as the other Freedom Flotilla vessels that participated in the last attempt to break the blockade, was any indication, certainly there's going to be a much more increased support for the Israeli government and the military to maintain the naval blockade on the Gaza Strip. It's very unlikely that the Israeli government or the military would in any way, shape, or form allow the Iranian vessels to enter Gaza's territorial waters and ultimately dock in Gaza's port. In fact, what we haven't heard from the Israeli government is the same offer that was made to previous vessels from European countries and other friendly countries, if you will, that they would be allowed to port in the Israeli city of Ashdod, offload their cargo, and then the government would, after inspecting it, deliver it to the people of Gaza. No such offer has been made to the Iranian vessel, so you get a sense really of how much tension exists in this particular attempt to break the naval blockade.
Yeah, clearly they don't want the ships or the aid anywhere near their territory. Is there any concern over whether Iran would send warships to look after these aid vessels?
Well, that's certainly another scenario that is very highly unlikely. In fact, we've heard either officially or unofficially from various players in the region that they do not want to see these types of war vessels or any kind of navy attempting to break the blockade. The organizers of the previous flotillas and others have insisted that this was a form of civilian action to break Israel's blockade. They don't want to see a military escalation of any kind, but rather civil disobedience. They believe that Gaza is under an illegal blockade, as has been reiterated by many international organizations. And what they want to see, really, is more international outrage followed by government action to deliberately break the blockade. So I don't think anyone wants to see a naval escort, if you will, of aid cargo, because it would also politicize what many of these organizers are trying to do, which is simply send a message that the blockade is illegal and that the people of Gaza need this aid.
Okay, well, we wait to see what happens on that. Eamon, thanks for that update. Eamon Mohyuddin in Jerusalem there. Meanwhile, 10,000 tons of aid sent by an international flotilla of ships is still sitting in Israel, with no sign of it moving to Gaza. Five truckloads of it were sent to the Kerem Abu Salem crossing, but after Hamas refused to accept it as a political statement, the trucks turned around and went back to base. So, where's the aid now? Nicole Johnston reports from Gaza.
Nine activists on board the Mavi Marmara died trying to deliver this aid to Gaza, but the goods are still in Israel, at an army base near Tel Aviv. Laid out in the sun is everything from wheelchairs to shoes, dentist chairs, even sewing machines. Israel is keeping the medicine from the flotilla indoors, but there are accusations that the aid has become a tool for all sides to push their political agendas. Israel says it's ready to send it to Gaza, except for construction material. But donors want all of it delivered.
We said we are not agree with you, because we want iron and cement, very important for us, for our organization in Gaza.
There's also resistance from Hamas. They say Israel only wants to deliver the aid for positive publicity.
This aid belongs to Turkey and it's taken from the Turkish people and Turkish land. So we say the decision should be taken by the Turkish government and organizations. And they say we should receive all of the aid, not part of it.
While all of the sides are debating what should happen to the aid from the flotilla, many of the people in Gaza who would have benefited from it have now given up any hope of seeing it.
Adli Dadona's house was destroyed during the war. If the flotilla aid had made it to Gaza, he would have received a new house. But he is adamant Gaza should not accept Israel's conditions.
The situation should stay the same until Israel allows all the aid from the flotilla to arrive. It's not fair that some people receive part of the aid and some people do not.
So instead of a new house, he'll keep living in this tin shack with his boys and his wife. The flotilla may have succeeded in reminding the world about the siege on Gaza, but somewhere along the way, the other goal of delivering aid seems to have been lost. Nicole Johnston, Al Jazeera, Gaza. Ritaj is 10 months old and she's wasting away. Malnourished and anemic, she only weighs 7 kilos.
Of course it's from the lack of food. My husband doesn't work. He used to make furniture. But I had to sell my gold to buy a car so he could be a taxi driver. But that didn't work either.
Shireen says she can't afford to buy the food her baby needs, so she comes to this clinic for help. Local doctors say the growth and development of 14% of children across Gaza has been stunted. And in almost 4% of cases, children are wasting away.
We are providing the people of Gaza is nearly 55% only of the calories that their bodies need. And you can go to one of UNRWA clinics and you will look at the babies. They are short and their weight is not the right weight.
This is one of the places you can go to in Gaza to collect food aid. People who were once able to provide for their families now depend on these handouts.
This is a typical amount of United Nations aid for a family of around three or four children. And you can see here we have
two bags of flour, and then very basic supplies. Some tins of meat, olive oil, rice, sugar, some powdered milk, that's about it. The thing is, they only receive this around every 3 months.
One bag of food is not enough. If we were to calculate it, each person needs one piece of bread, and this is not enough for four children.
The United Nations says 80% of people in Gaza rely on food aid, and that equates to a humanitarian crisis.
This has destroyed the industrial, the agriculture, the trade sector. If you have 3,500 factories are completely shut down, completely closed, where are these guys? They used to work. There's no work.
Without jobs and money, buying food has become a great challenge in Gaza. And this siege has made the vulnerable even weaker. Nicole Johnston, Al Jazeera, Gaza.
You tune to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org. Right now I'm going to play the documentary that was just released by Al Jazeera English called A Voyage of Life and Death. You can check it out on YouTube, or you could also check out culturesofresistance.org. They have a lot of videos, including this one there, Voyage of Life and Death. The story of the Gaza flotilla. Stay tuned, Free Radio.
Israeli commandos descended upon the ship in international water.
The organizers' intent was violent, their method was violent, and the results were unfortunately violent.
We came to deliver humanitarian aid. That was our primary purpose.
Obviously, the goal of this flotilla was not humanitarian aid. It was only to target IDF soldiers, to target them, to break their bones and their arms.
Resistance. They are using live ammunition. We cannot protect ourselves.
Nine deaths, dozens of injuries, over 600 detentions, international outrage. All the results of a lethal confrontation at sea. A confrontation that once again places Israel's illegal blockade of Gaza in the spotlight.
This wharf just behind me on the Bosphorus was the location where the ships loaded their cargo of aid supplies and set sail for Gaza.
In stark contrast to what was to follow, spirits were high.
There was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of excitement among the activists.
They used to hold these singing, sessions, which I think it's all in Turkish. I didn't understand any word of it, but I think it's all supporting that cause, playing the flute or something like that. And you can tell that all these people are happy because they're, trying to do something.
And it was amazing to see so many people from different countries with different faiths all coming together for this humanitarian cause, to just bring some relief to the people, to Palestinians who've been under siege for so long.
The convoy was organized by the Free Gaza Movement in conjunction with the Turkish humanitarian aid group IHAHA. The passenger ferry, MV Mavi Marmara, was to transport the vast majority of volunteers, while the accompanying vessels contained some 10,000 tons of badly needed supplies. It was hoped that the aid convoy could make a real difference to the 1.5 million Gazans who have been effectively cut off from the outside world for 3 years. And one or two of the activists even dared to imagine that they could end the blockade.
For the first few days, we just wished, that we would reach Gaza safely, and we were thinking and dreaming about what the people would be like there and how we would be able to help them, and you know, what we'd be able to feed them, and the joy of meeting these people who've been under suffering and the joy that we would give them.
People were really, really upbeat and thinking, many of them believing that they would reach Gaza and deliver the aid and meet with the Palestinians who were, are under siege. And you can imagine the feeling of, you know, yeah, this is going to be really great.
The so-called Freedom Flotilla was just the latest in a long line of aid missions to have tried to penetrate the ring of steel surrounding the Gaza Strip. Members of the Viva Palestina charity, led by former British MP George Galloway, had reached Gaza in March 2009 after an epic 8,000-kilometer road trip.
Inshallah, with the grace of Allah, we have come to Gaza. Allahu Akbar!
Amid chaotic scenes, the convoy delivered aid including ambulances, fire engines, food, clothing and medicine.
We are opposing this siege. We are breaking this siege.
And prior to the war in Gaza, members of the Free Gaza Movement had successfully delivered aid to the territory by sea on several separate occasions, beginning in August 2008.
If they fire in the air, not at the boat, that they're only trying to scare us.
What we wanted to do was keep going.
We gotta go and do it and break the siege and push it like we've always done.
The scale of their achievement was made clear by the joyous reaction that greeted their arrival. But a different fate awaited those on board the Freedom Flotilla. In the aftermath of the deadly raid on the Mavi Marmara, Israeli officials would line up to condemn the convoy and the campaigners.
The organizers are well known for their ties to global jihad, Al-Qaeda and Hamas.
This wasn't a love boat. This was a hate boat. These weren't pacifists, they weren't peace activists. These were violent supporters of terrorism.
But were they really? The more than 600 passengers, drawn from over 30 nations, included several parliamentarians, a best-selling Swedish author, an 81-year-old former American ambassador, and a one-year-old baby. Also on board the flotilla were seven Al Jazeera journalists, 63-year-old architect Peter Venner, Jean St. Ange, a civil engineer, and Anne Wright, a former US Army colonel and diplomat, all united by a common goal.
I'm the same age as Israel, I should point out. I was born in 1947, so I've known from quite early years that I wasn't being presented with the whole truth, and I'd heard from various sources, I suppose, essentially from the newspapers and so on, that Israel was a brave little country existing against the odds with hostile neighbours, and so we should be proud to support Israel. It wasn't many years, because my parents were very open-minded and discussed all sorts of things. It wasn't many years later, I suppose I was seven or eight, when I began to realise that I hadn't been told the whole truth, and that Israel was in fact existing in a country that had belonged to somebody else.
I'm a student in Australia, in Gold Coast, the University of Bond, doing international relations. And since a young age, I've been interested in watching the news, crises around the world, and the Palestinian sufferings has been something that's quite overwhelming and caught my interest for a while. So when I'd read about it and I'd read about, you know, the wars and massacres and then the human rights violations and then when the siege happened and all the humanitarian catastrophes that were going on, I obviously felt that I wish there was something in the least possible way that I could do to help them.
But even as the Freedom Flotilla prepared to set sail, battle lines were being drawn. The Israeli authorities warned that the convoy would not be allowed to dock in Gaza. Meanwhile, some activists maintained that they would defend their vessels against any attack.
The organizers of the flotilla said, "We want to tell the Israelis clearly that we will not let them board the ship."
The six ships comprising the Freedom Flotilla rendezvoused off the coast of Cyprus on the afternoon of Sunday, May the 30th, before setting sail to Gaza. But they would never reach their destination. For many on board the Mavi Marmara, the voyage to Gaza was the result of months of careful planning. And as the flotilla advanced towards the territory, the sense of expectation grew.
I find myself and others anticipating what is to come, what awaits us.
On Sunday night, around 7 or 8 p.m., one of the organizers announced on the speakers that everyone should be ready at 7 a.m. next morning because we will be on the shores of Gaza or close by the shores of Gaza.
But as night fell, the feeling of optimism gave way to one of foreboding.
Israeli boats were seen on the horizon, Israeli military ships were seen on the horizon, and that there was some communication between them and the captain, and that they asked the captain, "Who are you? Where are you going?" Just a few questions, and the captain told them, "We are the Free Gaza Flotilla, and we are going to Gaza."
People were sort of telling us, Israelis, they might come on board, they might, we don't know, they've sent submarines.
Mavi Marmara, you are approaching an area of hostilities, which is under a naval blockade.
Saat 22:30 civarında çağrıları ilk olarak almaya başladı.
At around 22:30, we started receiving the calls. What they wanted from us was to change our route completely. Our answer was that they could not ask us to change our route in international waters.
Around 11:15, we could already see dim lights in the horizon, and everybody knew the Israelis were coming. And that was the last time I did a live report here to the channel saying we are now in the company of the Israeli Navy.
What we know is that people have been asked to be on the alert and they have been asked to put life jackets, and everybody is alert now and everything is expected. This is a surprise to us because the plan for this flotilla was to move slowly so that they can reach Gaza in the morning. Not exactly Gaza, but not far from its national waters. Now we are still more than 120 miles away. And
well, we seem to have lost our line there to Mohammed Val. So apologies for that slight technical problem.
We stayed awake for till 1:30 a.m., me and Mohammed Val, where we decided that, you know, like, okay, let's have some sleep because tomorrow morning will be a big day.
They're not pressing us, they're just coming. The Gaza area, coastal region, and Gaza harbor are closed to all maritime traffic.
The calls continued until the early hours. Then at 2 o'clock, all the calls stopped.
We started seeing all these spy planes going around everywhere, and then warships in the distance just coming up. And they came in like, I don't know, like they were about to invade, you know, a country, and we were on a little boat, you know.
At 4 a.m., I woke up on the call for prayer.
Allah.
We were told to put on, or we put on life jackets, as we were expecting there could be trouble to come.
I was washing my face where I noticed there is a small Zodiac just beside the window, full with soldiers.
Somebody shouted to say, essentially, they're here.
And when we actually saw them, they were with all their Zodiacs, yeah, and all 20 men dressed in there, it looked like death was written all over them, yeah.
Then somebody brought a powerful torch, shone it over the side, and at a short distance away we could see first one and then another four or five gunboats who were following along in our wake, rather as a pack of dogs might follow you.
I was surprised, you know, like I said, maybe I'm still dreaming, you know, like I really, literally, you know, I put some more water on my face when I looked back on the window and here are the soldiers coming by, just nearby the windows of the ship, closer and closer.
It was a grey shape, long and rather malevolent looking shape, and you could see that there were soldiers aboard. You couldn't see what weapons they were carrying, but we knew they must be armed.
All we were thinking about is, what about all these old people? What about the women? What about the kids?
We were surrounded like by 20 to 30 Zodiacs and like speedboats, you know, army speedboats. And all the soldiers were wearing masks, so all what you can tell is their eyes. And their guns, you know, like pointing on the ship or on the passengers.
A moment later, there was a very loud explosion. Some light from this thing had been set off.
Because of the explosions, I thought that already people are dying in scores because of the sound of the explosions and the luminous light that I saw.
I was on the first deck on the rear end of the ship where 20 Turkish people were making a human chain armed with wood sticks and water pipes. And hitting the sides of the ship, making big bangs, you know, like, and I think these guys were really no fear with them, you know, like, they were ready, you know, like, okay, just come on, you know, we're ready for you guys.
And some of us were shouting, don't come on board, don't do this, that. And some of us were near the hose, like, you know, I'm gonna spray water at them. All of the skies, there's helicopters, just about maybe 4 or 5 meters above our heads coming in, you know, with the sounds.
I heard a rattle, rattling sound, as rather above me in the ship, in the upper works of the ship, as though pebbles were being thrown against the steel plate. And it dawned on me that these might be perhaps rubber bullets.
Panic had set in, and people were saying Israelis had just they started firing just randomly, riddling the place with bullets, you know, and couldn't understand why. I mean, I think they'd even, I didn't realize they'd even arrived yet and they'd been firing, you know.
The first attempt of boarding the ship by the helicopter, you know, like, the helicopter just came by the roof, top side of the ship, with ropes coming down on it, and three or four soldiers tried to come down.
Saldırılarda herhangi bir uyarı olmadığı gibi, İsrail'in iddia ettiği gibi aşağı.
Without any warning, the soldiers were shooting as they came down on the ropes. The passengers were not warned at all. I was on the bridge and I saw them very clearly firing gunshots. They came down also throwing gas bombs. Only after the soldiers started attacking the passengers did they take away the soldiers' guns.
I saw them bringing an Israeli soldier who was captured, and then another one, and then another one.
The Turkish guys were ready on top of the on the deck, and they just grabbed them. The moment they were trying to come on board of the ship, they captured them and they were beaten pretty bad.
Do you think it was a bad idea for the passengers to try to resist once the Israelis tried to board on the ship?
The Israeli side of the story, you know, like when they said they were, you know, like had weapons, slingshots, knives, you know, like these are not, these are, you know, like medieval age weapons, you know, like towards what we had on the other side, you know, like machine guns, weapons, you know, like all sorts of weapons, you know, like helicopters, you know, like you cannot say that we will fight these soldiers with such kind of weaponry or whatever.
İsrail'in gösterdiği silah diye kullandığımızı gösterdiği şeyler gerçekten de bir gemi hakkında bilgi.
The things that Israel showed as weapons on the ship are actually very funny for people who know something about ships. What they showed as weapons were axes. We have 8 fire emergency stations on the ships. All these axes and tools were collected on the ship. We also have a lot of tools in the engine room. There are a lot of screwdrivers and hammers that were collected. All the knives in all the 7 cafeterias were collected. All of them were displayed as weapons.
The Israeli soldiers, as one of my friends who witnessed, who was on the third deck, he said they fired some tear gas bombs and some, I think they call it sound grenades. It's not, they just make big bangs, you know, and some smoke grenades. There was no direct shoot, or at least live bullets. The live bullets were used after the 3 soldiers were captured.
I was walking to the side to get inside the cabin, and I just, from just up there where above, from where the helicopters were hovering, this bullet just comes and hits me in my leg. I'm guessing it was from the helicopter. Surprisingly, I didn't feel any pain on the spot. I just knew I've got to move or another one's coming. And sure enough, a second one did come and graze me there. I tried to put my leg back down so I can walk, get out of here. It wouldn't do it, so I was there for a few seconds. And then when I managed to force it down, it sunk in that I've been shot. So I climbed over the, into the, over the door, I climbed over it and started walking down the stairs, and then I just collapsed, I think.
The first helicopter, when they arrived and started descending from the helicopter to board the ship, and after the Turkish resistance, I call them Turkish resistance, they took them and beat them. A second helicopter arrived, I think, with the order shoot to kill. And this is where they opened live shots, I mean live bullets. They used live bullets on the passengers on board of the ship.
İlk içeriye girdiklerinde yaklaşık 10 tane asker içeriye girdi. Ellerinde her türlü...
About 10 soldiers came fully equipped with their guns. They made the entire crew lie down and handcuffed them, except me. When they told me to lie down, I refused to do so. So they brought me to the captain's chair and told me to sit down and not to move.
Okay, fantastic.
Within minutes of boarding the 6 vessels that comprised the Freedom Flotilla, Israeli commandos had begun to quell any resistance from the passengers by any means necessary.
Some of this for... Give me the onion. No, give me the onion.
Indonesia.
As dawn broke over the Mediterranean on the morning of May the 31st, the 3 injured Israeli combatants on board the Mavi Marmara were being treated by the ship's medics, even as their fellow activists were being killed.
With the Israeli soldiers captured, there was lots of blood covered their faces, and you can tell it's all by they were beaten really, really bad.
The three soldiers that had been captured were taken downstairs to the medical room, where doctors performed first aid.
They were shaken. Their eyes were bulging out, and they were just freaking out. Their eyes were red. They were really scared.
They hauled two soldiers down here, bleeding and wounded.
The Turkish injured and the Arab injured people, you know, like, they had lots of direct bullets, wounds in their thighs, arms, chest. One of the Algerian delegates, he got a rubber bullet in his eye.
Did it suggest to you that people were shot in a chaotic way, or did it suggest to you that they were targeted?
It was targeted, like sniper way. Especially, I filmed that man who got a bullet just in his forehead, and who died directly, you know, like a direct target, you know, like a hit in his head. The second man who was standing after another man, you know, like beside him in a way, he got a direct hit in his neck. And these two died on the spot.
What were you thinking in the middle of all of this violence?
Nothing. I was kind of like, I had this shield, you know, like that. I couldn't feel, or I didn't let myself feel anything because I was filming. And if I let my emotions to start kicking in, you know, like, I think I won't hold the camera again. You know, like, I will stop filming, and I don't know.
The quantity of blood was quite astounding. You know, it was thick, very thick blood. And from then on, you could smell blood around the vessel. Very strong smell of blood, which again remains in my memory clearly. He was carried into what had been the press room, which was being set up as a hospital. And almost as soon as he'd been taken through, he was completely unable to move himself. He may have been dead.
How long did it take from all of this chaos, from Israel descending onto the boat, all of this chaos, until the Israeli soldiers had complete control of the boat?
After they shot these two guys, one in the forehand and one in the neck, and they were dead on the spot, the other guys tried to help these two guys to take them inside. This is where the human chain on the backside of the ship just split up. And this is when the soldiers start boarding the ship from the sea level. So at that moment, I decided to stop filming because it's not worth risking my life anymore.
There was a time when those three soldiers were brought inside the ship. There was a kind of calm, a little bit of calm, like for a few minutes, which gave me the impression that maybe they ran away, or maybe because their soldiers have been captured, they're not going to do more violence now for fear their soldiers would be killed. But that was like a matter of maybe 2 minutes or a little more, and then more wounded, more dead people were brought in, and more sounds of gunshots were heard. And all along the helicopter, the sound of the helicopter machines, engines, was like the ship was literally like shaking.
The fight on the top of the ship was still going on because you can still hear the bullets, the sound of the bullets. And those who boarded the ship from the sea, they did not get into our cabins or into the passenger area. They locked the door, the main door that leads to the back of the ship, and they were pointing their guns with a laser beam from the windows on all the passengers. And you're like, they're pointing their guns and asking people to sit down. You know, like, with the beam, you can tell that they're ordering us to sit down on the floor or on the couches or whatever. I think around 4:45 or 4:55 a.m. the ship was under control by the Israeli army, full control.
The assault on the Mavi Marmara was over within 45 minutes. 9 people lay dead, in some cases having been shot in the head, chest or back at close range. And for those who survived, the ordeal continued.
After the Israelis took control of the ship, this is where my feelings start kicking in. I mean, my emotions, you know. The only person that I was thinking of at that moment is my wife, because I knew how much she would be suffering now, you know. When she hear the news, she will be losing her mind. After that, one of the organizers starts speaking in English, you know, like asking the Israeli soldiers to give us help, or medical help for the injured. In return, they will release Israeli soldiers. That lasted around 1 hour of negotiations, in a way, until they decided, okay, hand us the soldiers. They took the soldiers out, and they start asking one by one, you know, like, just start getting one injured after one, after another, outside the ship. We didn't know where they were taking these injured people, by sea, by helicopter, because we were still sitting.
Between 6 and 6:30, they began to, everything was really calm, and we began to see more and more soldiers behind the windows from the glass. And then they got inside the ship from different entries, from inside the passenger compartments. And then they announced that now everybody should, one by one, should just raise their hands and walk to the door and do whatever they are told to do. So people began to move, to go like in that way. And everybody who reached the entry of the passenger compartment were handcuffed.
At around 6:30 in the morning, we were asked to start the engine and turn the route to 130 degrees. No matter how many times I asked the Israeli soldiers to provide first aid to the injured or to let our doctors intervene, they kept on insisting that as long as the engine was not started and the route was not turned towards 130 degrees, they would not provide first aid.
We were kneeling, rather uncomfortable, on the iron plates, steel plates of the ship, and with our hands behind us, you get cramp and so on. And as I say, we were held at rifle point. They said, on a megaphone, they told us that they were going to take us out one at a time.
At that time it was morning, but later on it began to be very hot, and people were really suffering. And some of the passengers were handcuffed like this, and some behind their backs, depending on how dangerous the Israelis think this person is.
When my turn arrived, they directly put plastic cuffs, you know, like on my hand, and they searched me. They only left on me, like, they took my mobile, they took everything, any kind of electronics, or even like the cable for the charger to charge my mobile, you know, they took everything. They left me with my passport and with my wallet. That's it. And then they took us to the third floor on the deck of the ship. The second floor and the third floor was all full with passengers. Their hands are tied. And my turn was on the third floor in the sun with the woman and with different, you know, like, people there. We stayed on board of the on the top of the deck for around 3 hours.
The airlifting of the wounded and the dead began, and it took hours. So it's like every 15 to 20 minutes a giant helicopter would hover above the ship.
We were all surrounded by soldiers pointing their tasers and paintball gun or their pistols on us, you know. and whoever start talking or making some loud noises, you know, like they used to ask them to shut and to sit down, no moving or something like that. Some of these people, you know, like they replied back with a very harsh way, you know, like, and this is where the soldiers, you know, like kind of treated them in a bad way, you know, like they forced them to sit down and to keep shut.
Ve özellikle helikopterler,
the choppers began spraying cool seawater on the passengers in the cool morning weather in order to pressure them psychologically and physically.
There was silence among the passengers at that particular point in time. People were not talking like they used to talk. People not willing to really say something that would brought the anger and punishment from the Israeli soldiers who were pointing their guns at their heads. The voyage took about 10 hours or even more, because we reached Ashdod only at twilight, I mean around 6:30. That can give you an idea about the distance from the place where the Israelis attacked us and the Israeli shore itself.
At the port of Ashdod, they tied our hands. Another search on board of the ship, and they let us one by one to step out. When my turn arrived, two soldiers, I think, with different cloth color or something, you know, one grabbed me from each side, and they took me to an interrogation unit in a way.
When we arrived, there were crowds of Israelis chanting and hailing the soldiers for what they think is a great deed they did.
It would be more than 24 hours before many of the detainees were allowed to make contact with the outside world. But the information vacuum was quickly filled, as Israel's propaganda machine went into overdrive. Mark Regev and Avital Leibovich, veterans of the PR war on Gaza, took turns to castigate the flotilla activists, while insisting that the Israeli commandos had acted in self-defense in boarding the vessels and killing 9 people.
They have exposed themselves. Their real agenda is not to help the people of Gaza. They want to support the authoritarian Hamas regime.
Any metal bar pointed at someone's head can kill, as well as dozens of knives. These are not tools used to cut salad.
Apparently, these activists were not interested in delivering humanitarian aid. They were interested in making a radical political statement.
How can this organization that is calling itself a human rights organization choose the method of violence as a tactic?
It's clear that the violence was initiated by the people on the boat. It's clear that if they initiated the violence, they are responsible for the violence.
Live fire was used against our forces, as well as sharp items, knives of different sorts.
Our young servicemen were attacked with live ammunition. They were shot at with knives and with clubs.
Yet no evidence has emerged to suggest that any passengers on the Mavi Marmara used firearms.
They weren't soldiers, they weren't, you know, like terrorists. They were like you and me, you know, like, I mean, normal people on board of the ship trying to break the siege, supporting the cause of Gaza and the Palestinian cause.
And as footage of the raid began to emerge, the Israeli authorities were quick to attach emotive language to the images, while simultaneously refusing to confirm the exact sequence of events.
If you wouldn't mind answering the question, were your troops fired upon before they opened fire, or did they open fire first?
I think this is premature to investigate exactly or debrief what has happened. The event is only 48 hours behind us.
I'm sure you know. I'm sure you know the answer. Why can't you give it to us? Did they fire first, or did the people on the boat fire first?
I'll give it very straightforward. Our forces came from a number of means. One of them was the helicopter. The forces that were in the helicopter could not open fire because they were beaten before they reached the landing of the ship.
All right, but who opened fire first?
Once again, the footage shows clearly. Soldiers came down, tried to enter the ship, and they were beaten with rods before having the ability to even fire. And this was released and broadcasted all over the world.
Okay, but I mean, these are pictures that you have chosen to release. We don't know what happened before that. But once again, Major, who opened fire first? The Israelis or those on board the ship?
Once again, we are not with a complete investigation at this point. So I will not give you any suggestions of exactly what happened, but I can tell you, according to the footage and the fighters I've spoken to, before stepping one foot on board of the ship, they were attacked.
Came from the Israelis. All the members of Challenge 2 on the Israelis. Different ships, who's on them? Who to concentrate on?
Meanwhile, a recording surfaced that appeared to suggest that some activists had been deliberately targeted in advance of the raid.
In the pictures, they were, you know, they were picture of the Raid Salah. Instead of killing Raid Salah, they killed the other one. They killed another people who looks like a Raid Salah. And then the Raid Salah said that, you know, when they killed that guy, the soldier was telling the others, we finished off Raid Salah. You know, so all the ship list is ready, they prepared, and then they, from each ship, which people will be killed or will be taken away.
And despite Israel's best efforts, it seemed that their propaganda war had already been lost, as the international community united in condemnation of the lethal assault on the Freedom Flotilla.
Turkey is going to use all the means available to her by international law and will act together with the international community. I would like to draw attention to the people of the world. This is an illegal attack. No one can explain, no one can justify this attack. Israel cannot clean the blood in their hands using any excuse.
I'm shocked by reports of killings and injuries of people on the boats carrying supplies for Gaza, apparently in international waters.
We as elders condemn Israel utterly for this attack and for the death it has caused. The actions of the Israeli forces were completely inexcusable.
Even Israel's staunchest ally, the US, was unusually forthright in its post-raid comments.
Not only is the status quo with respect to Gaza unsustainable, the status quo with respect to the Middle East is unsustainable.
And yet, despite the barrage of international criticism that followed in the wake of the deadly raid, Israel's stranglehold on Gaza remains unbroken.
It's a lost cause. It's a lost cause. Yes, you will push, you will, you know, like, I mean, people, governments can push and put some pressure on Israel. But I know Israel.
As for the flotilla's passengers, the lucky ones returned home to heroes' welcomes.
The moment that we stepped out and we saw all that gathering, all these people, you know, like, waiting for us, it was a big moment. I mean, it was really emotional moment for me. And when I saw my mom, it was amazing. I mean, I was happy.
But the whole tragic incident had left its mark on the survivors.
What did you leave with that you had on you before you actually boarded the ship?
My clothes, the clothes that I had on Sunday morning, and my passport. In terms of physical belongings, but in terms of psychological and personal, internal, I didn't lose anything except perhaps the slight feeling that Israelis could behave rationally.
Yet many of the activists remain determined to repeat their attempt to break the blockade.
If there's another flotilla, will you sail again to Gaza?
Kesinlikle.
I would definitely go, and I would be honored to do so.
If there's another ship, we're going to try to organize an Australian ship, or we'll at least have a wish to do so. I wonder how possible it is, but we'll try. And we'll most definitely be on the next ship or any other method that we can do to get this some humanitarian assistance to these people.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, Pop Defect Radio, popdefectradio.blogspot.com. That was just a brand new documentary. It just came out June 14th, 2010, but the flotilla attack by Israeli Army, A Voyage of Life and Death, it's called. You can go to culturesofresistance.org or find it on YouTube. Again, it's called A Voyage of Life and Death. This is a Palestinian band called Dam with My Hurry, which means I don't have freedom.
عايشين ورا سجون البنود اللي سجنين لنا ما يتغير مش حاسين ولا نور الا سياج منها احنا شايفين سما لونها ازرق غير ما ابيض بالنص جمد زكراك انت بغير بس انا صامد عايش متفائل ما تعزل مني الامل بيجي ضار فاصل بالسور يدور انا مربوط فلسطين كجنين لحبل الطابور بالارض جذور شجر زيتون ضل يتولد وتجدد وتجدد قصور والغصن ممدود للسلام معروض لاحتلال ما يريد استسلام ليه أنا اللي ما إله حرية لأني أنا رافض إني أعيش بعبودية
وين ما رحت أشوف حدود السجن الإنساني لأطفال العالم حرة وأنا مالي حرية وين ما رحت أشوف حدود السجن الإنساني لأطفال العالم حرة وأنا مالي حرية
إحنا بندور على السلام بين قوات حرب رواد حرب مهم صرنا أولاد نطلب الحرية من السجون المعنية انه نكون معيون اللي دايما معمية من التفرج اطفال العالم الحرة دايما ضل بتدحرج للحياة المرة قوانا شاطرين بس بتبهرج الكلام كلهم مخدين تخرج بتعرج الاوطان واحنا نستعمل قوة عشان الضعف بنتحمل الموت عشان الحياة عملنا بلطف ومش بعسف للحياة ولدنا ولما لقيناها مش بيدينا جربنا نخدها فمتنا وكل طلبنا كان نفس واللي ضحينا عشانه برضو كان نفس انت قولي ليش اطفال العالم حرة وانا مالي انا مالي حرية
وين ما رحت اشوف حدود سجن الانساني لاطفال العالم حرة وانا مالي حرية وين ما رحت اشوف حدود سجن الانساني لاطفال العالم حرة وانا مالي حرية
انا بديش اعيش عركبي وانا بديش اموت اجرم وانا لساتي شايف الاحتلال مادد ايده مش للسلام مش مساواة بل تيهديني حبل مشلقة كمان مش ظلام وجدار اللي فاصل بيني وبين اهلي ما بخليني اشوف ضوء السماء مهم الواحد وخمسين ولاية تربي كمان ولاية اللي تربى على حساب غيرها متأثرة من امها الهنود الحمر متأملة تمحينا تغسل دماغنا تقولنا انه المشكلة هي احنا
بس حتى جيوش العالم كلها ما تقدر على الحرية
نريد جيلاً
رائدا عملاق.